Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Hello, everybody, and welcome back to New Books in Native American Studies, a podcast channel on the New Books Network. I'm your host, Annabella Breck, and today we'll be talking to Benjamin Dongle about his new book, The 500-Year Rebellion, Indigenous Movements and the Decolonization of History in Bolivia. Benjamin Dongle, welcome to the show.
Thanks so much for having me on.
Ben, I wonder if you could kick things off today by telling us a bit about yourself.
Yeah, so I'm a journalist. I teach public communication at the University of Vermont in the Department of Community Development and Applied Economics. I got my PhD in history, focusing on Latin American history from McGill University in Montreal. I've worked as a journalist throughout Latin America for over 15 years. I've written three books on Bolivia, with an emphasis on Bolivia, and reported on human rights, politics, protest movements around the region for places like Vice, The Guardian, Al Jazeera, NACLA Report on the Americas. And I came to focus on Latin America in the early 2000s during a shift to the left in the halls of power, and ended up writing about that throughout that tumultuous period into today. And I came to write this book as a result of those experiences. The 500-Year Rebellion comes out of my doctoral research and is a result of years of archival research and many, many interviews with indigenous activists and leaders in Bolivia.
In your introduction, you lay out the contemporary context of your research, a period of Bolivian history largely defined by the presidency of indigenous Aymar and Evo Morales, and punctuated by historical symbolism, promise, and aspiration. This is apparent in everything from quotidian dialogue to presidential discourse, as you show in your book. Over the course of your research, what first prompted you to notice these influences, and how did that bring you to write The 500-Year Rebellion?
So in 2003, I worked as a journalist in Bolivia, and during a period of major upheaval in what came to be called Bolivia's gas war. This was a conflict over a plan to privatize and export Bolivian gas, basically extend the privatization of Bolivian gas for a very low price to the U.S. And people in Bolivia rose up against this plan, which they saw as a continuation of 500 years of looting of the country, of their natural resources by foreign corporations and governments. And during these protests, people rose up to say, we want our gas used for national development. We want our natural resources to be used for national development. And the president at the time, Gonzalo Sanchez de Lozada, who was known as Goni, repressed these protests. And the protests morphed into a deeper rejection of Goni's politics. He represented neoliberalism for many Bolivians, a harsh economic ideology which ripped resources and political agency from many working class and poor sectors in the country over decades. So during the gas war, when I was there, people were setting up road blockades in the streets. And road blockades are very important in Bolivia, in a place where, at that time especially, there aren't many paved roads. And once protesters block major highways, it really puts pressure on the government as a form of protest for the government to to pay attention to those protesters. And so at the barricades at this time, people were making references to 500 years of rebellion, to 500 years of resistance against what they saw as the recolonization of Bolivia by, in this case, of modern corporations and neoliberal governments. And they also spoke about how many of them were carrying on the traditions of Tupac Katari, an 18th century indigenous Aymara rebel leader who in the late 1700s, 1781, organized an indigenous army to lay siege to colonial La Paz when it was in control of the Spanish, and created basically barricades around that city to put the region back in indigenous hands so that, as Katari said, we alone will rule once again. And that those barricades, that siege of La Paz, stayed alive in the imaginations and the histories and the oral histories in Bolivia from below, passed from person to person through activist networks. It wasn't a history that was championed and celebrated in official discourse or in mainstream textbooks and in histories of the country. The history of Tupac Katari's rebellion and of other rebellions was really something that was carried on through oral traditions over centuries. And so when I was witnessing this resurgence of this Catarista type of activity, of this activism at the barricades, I thought, who has been maintaining these histories? How have these memories and these histories of resistance from Katari, but also of other rebel leaders in Bolivia, how have these been maintained? And that's what kind of led me to the idea for the 500 Year Rebellion, this book. And in following these questions, I was able to put some of the pieces together and follow these threads to realize that when people set up barricades and echo Katari, and when indigenous leaders cite this 500 years of resistance against Spanish colonization, and when they put the indigenous martyrs and rebels on the banners and placards in their marches, they're really carrying on a deep tradition that has been a part of indigenous movements in Bolivia for centuries. And my book looks particularly at how indigenous movements in the 20th century and into the 21st have picked up those threads and carried on those traditions. And so I look at the ways that those historical tools of resistance have been used from basically for 500 years, but also looking up to the Evo Morales administration. So in the book, I look at the ways that these traditions have been carried on through oral history, through street barricades where people are practicing these memories and these histories in action. I look at the ways that activist scholars have researched different rebel histories and created pamphlets and radio programs about them. I looked at the ways that indigenous movements have created manifestos that bring up the story of the IU, a form of community organizing that goes back thousands of years in the Andes. Brings up the IU as a kind of nucleus of political organization. So the sustaining, the reproduction of these histories is hard work on the ground, and it's been done by indigenous activists for a long time. And I look at specific instances of how history has been used as a tool for revolution, for liberation, by activists. And the book is based on extensive interviews with a lot of these leaders and archival research, looking at the documents and the material they've published over these years.
In chapter one, we're introduced to two strains of indigenous Andean ideology, largely born out of indigenous responses to the Bolivian National Revolution in the 1950s. Catarismo, which, as you mentioned before, is named after Tupac Katari, and Indianismo. How did these two ideologies form, and where do they diverge and overlap?
So in the wake of the National Revolution, which took place in 1952, A number of very historic revolutionary reforms took place in terms of land reform, voter enfranchisement, and basically ending the hacienda and bringing a lot of the rural poor out of poverty and out of subservience in a kind of neo-colonial model. However, a lot of indigenous activists and indigenous people around the countryside came to resist some of the policies of the National Revolution and particularly as it morphed into a series of dictatorships starting in 1964, when military rule kind of began and staggered up until the early 1980s through a series of coups and military leaders, who were all different. But during this period of the 1960s, 1970s, Catarismo and Indianismo came to emerge as focal points in this resistance against state oppression, against indigenous people, and particularly state assimilation efforts to say where the state was wanting to, for example, ignore and suppress indigenous languages, indigenous dress, indigenous traditions and governance, to say we want you to be peasants in a union, not Aymara, Quechua people in an IU organized under your own traditions that that go back hundreds of years. We want you to be a kind of instrument of the state. And through Catarismo, particularly, which, as you mentioned, brought up the name of Catari as a kind of banner of its movement. In the 1970s, you have leaders like Genaro Flores, a leader in the highlands of La Paz, who wanted to break away from what was called the military Campesino Pact in the 1970s in particular, which was a form of subjugation of indigenous Campesino unions. And he wanted to create an independent union that represented the true needs, desires, politics of the rural indigenous majority and break with the government. And he did that through a series of and years of clandestine organizing against state oppression of the union. And throughout these efforts, what was really interesting in terms of my research was the ways that Genaro kind of rescued Catari from oblivion in a way. People had been talking about him, obviously, for a long time. But in this political context, Genaro and other historians like Roberto Choquecanqui and indigenous philosopher Fausto Reynaga, these people were involved in recovering and putting Qatari's history back on the map and using Qatari as a symbol to say, we aren't peasants, we're indigenous rebels. We have our own politics, we have our own languages, history. We want that to be respected. And Qatari was a symbol for that. Literally, his image was in one story when Cataristas were marching down La Paz on May Day, they were given President Torres's image at the time, and we're talking about the early 1970s. And they took that image, that portrait, and hid it under the ponchos and took out instead a portrait of Tupac Katari as a kind of a banner of their struggle. And at the same time, you have people like Genaro and other Cataristas saying, launching the Manifesto of Tiwanaku in 1973, which was a reclaiming of indigenous rebel history and centering of indigenous concepts such as Aini, kind of Indian reciprocity, where indigenous peoples were working together, were looking at political models where indigenous people were focused on working together through collaboration on the land through the IU, which is often a network expanding across various ecological zones where smaller communities are working together in the production, the political organization of their communities. This form of organization has persisted through the Spanish conquest and colonization into today. And so Cataristas were lifting up the IU as well as a kind of nucleus of their organization. And so They did this through organizing, campesino organizing on the ground, and the Indianistas with people like Constantino Lima and Luciano Tapia. These leaders kind of articulated their demands within this period through the organization of political parties. So they were seeking political power through the elections, where Cataristas were more seeking a voice in political intervention through the union. So the work of the Cataristas and the Indianistas throughout the 70s and into the 80s really laid the groundwork for a lot of the organizations that came afterwards, including the Andean Oral History Workshop, a national network of IUs, Concolamac. And so looking at this, the history of these organizations really helps understand the background and the context for what emerged in the 80s and 90s and into today. And a lot of the references to Qatari, to decolonization, to the IU, really owe a lot, in contemporary times, really owe a lot to these early interventions from Cataristas and Indianistas in the 1970s. So that's an important part of the book as well.
In chapter three, roughly three decades after the National Revolution that helped to prompt this sub-rebellion of sorts in indigenous intellectualism, the Unified Syndical Confederation of Rural Workers in Bolivia emerges amidst political turmoil. How does the indigenous Bolivian past inform and shape the aspirations, actions, and abilities of the Confederation and other union efforts during the 1980s?
I'm sorry, could you repeat that question? I missed the date that you referred to.
Yes, sure. How does the indigenous Bolivian past inform and shape the aspirations, actions, and abilities of the Confederation in the 1980s, a few decades after the National Revolution, and this outburst of Catarista and Indianista thought?
Great. So, yeah, the Cesud Sebe, the campesino organization that Genaro Flores started, had a pivotal role in the 1980s after the return to democracy in 83. And over that period, what they did was they would organize these road blockades around La Paz and around the country to pressure the government against austerity measures, or in some cases, you know, in the 1970s and early 80s, against dictatorships, unelected governments. And they would pressure the government, and they used literal strategies that Tupac Katari used in the late 18th century, strategies that included Plan Kuti, which is an organization of the rocks, basically, that they would use for blockades that could be moved quickly. And then Plan Tarachi, which is an organization of the blockades to what they said was strangle the city. And these were literal strategies that Qatari used, according to them, and are still used today by the Cesud Sebe and other organizations. And so from their road blockades, they issued communiques in the 1980s, communiques that were published in newspapers and said communiques which were basically little like history lessons from the barricade to say, we are carrying on 500 years of resistance. We are carrying on Tupac Katari's rebellion. And they did this really, really notably using history as a tool at the barricades to position themselves as heirs of indigenous rebels, as they said, heirs of great civilizations, to say we aren't slaves, we aren't victims, we are heroes, we are protagonists of our own history, and history is a tool for us as we organize. So Cesud Sebe did this from the barricades with their communiques, which I look at in detail as a part of the research in the book. And they also issued plans to reform reform land reform from the state level. And in their proposals, in their new agrarian law proposals, they did research and referenced back to the IU as a form of organization and reciprocal relationships working the land that really contested the government's way of conducting land reform. And so these were also historical tools that the Cesud Sebe used at the time.
In chapter 4, you highlight the significance of the Andean Oral History Workshop in this decades-long process of the decolonization of Bolivian history. Can you talk more about the formation of the workshop and how their work fundamentally shaped public as well as academic discourse?
Yeah, so the Andean information, the Andean Oral History Workshop, the TOA, T-H-O-A, was one of the most fascinating aspects of this research, and I think of the book. They started in 1983, was organized by, at the time, a professor at the main University of La Paz, Silvia Rivera Cusicanqui, who is a pivotal intellectual, historian, activist, who helped found the TOA, who really led the founding of the TOA in 1983, along with many of her students and colleagues at the university. And among this group of roughly a dozen students and professors, they reflected on the changes in the activism and the actions in the streets at this time, where you have Cataristas organizing in the street, you have campesino organizations resisting assimilation efforts. And they said, we want to reflect the kind of changes in the streets. We want to reflect that in the classroom, in our own historical explorations. And in their reflections, they realized and they kind of discussed and shared the fact that these histories of resistance are not taught in the classroom. These histories of resistance are not shared as a part of official discourse of Bolivian history. And they wanted to face the void and the emptiness around these histories in the archives, in the libraries, with oral history and going back to their communities that they came from and speaking with their elders, with their ancestors and their parents and grandparents in many of the communities that they came from. So many of the students that Cusicanqui, that Silvia Rivera worked with, came from the countryside. They spoke Aymara and Quechua. They came to the city in many cases to study for the first time living in the city. And as a part of the TOA's recovery of these histories, they went back to the countryside. And they described this as a process of self-investigation and of decolonization. They say they decolonized their own methodology as researchers by not just kind of mimicking what they said was the Western style of swooping into a community, doing a bunch of interviews, never to return. But instead, they decolonized their methodology of research by creating what they said was an olla común, or a common pot, where different testimonies and oral recordings were put into a kind of common pot where they would explore one research topic. They would put into this pot the archival documents, the newspaper documents that they found, and they would do this collectively and not just work among the core members of the TOA, but extend this participation and this reflection out to the community members that they were interviewing. So the subjects or interviewees were a critical part of the process of the production of the histories, the collection, the formation of the questions for the interviews, and even had a role in the final production and distribution of the histories that the TOA produced. So one of the key stories that I focus on in the book that was a key result of the TOA's early work in the 1980s was really the kind of rediscovery of this rural network of indigenous rebels and land defenders in the early 20th century. The TOA's rediscovery of the Caciques Apoderados, a network of indigenous leaders in the early 20th century, they were organized around the defense of community land and rights against the incursions of the hacienda and the government to dispossess, and private organizations to dispossess indigenous peoples of their land. And the Caciques Apoderados organized against this in a kind of relatively unprecedented at the time national network of hundreds of leaders that coordinated with each other. And they went to court, they went to political, talked with politicians on behalf of their communities. And one of the key leaders of this movement was Santos Marca Tula. Tula was a part of this. And when the TOA was looking into this, they said, the members that I spoke about, and I interviewed almost all of the TOA members for the book, they said at the time, the Caciques Apoderados, Santos Marcatula, the history of this movement was virtually unknown, undiscussed, not talked about in Bolivia. And the TOA, with the work of community members and ancestors and people who had participated or were related to these Caciques Apoderados, the TOA put this story back on the map. And they did this through the Olla Común process, and they did this by reaching out to elders that were linked up to these Caciques Apoderados, and Tula in particular, and speaking with them, speaking with their scribes, with their children, with people who knew these stories in their communities. And they put it together in a pamphlet, and it was translated, it was produced as a radio program as well in Aymara and Spanish, and it reached across the country, and they retold the story of Santos Marcatula and his national struggle in defense of his community in the highlands of Bolivia. And that is a key part of the book that I look at. And when I was with the TOA one rainy day in their offices, one of the many visits I made to them, one time I was sitting there and they said, "Oh, would you like to learn more about learn more about Tula? You should go. We can meet with his son." And I was astounded to learn that Tula's son was still alive. So Tula was killed in the early 1940s. But I was astounded to hear that his son was still alive. And I left with a TOA member from La Paz up to the city of El Alto. And we went to this low-level house in a kind of working-class neighborhood of El Alto. And I met Gregorio Barco Guarachi, Tula's last living immediate descendant, his last living son. And it was incredible to talk with Barco through a translator from the TOA in Aymara. He spoke only Aymara. He was almost entirely blind and deaf at that time. A few years ago, he was 96 years old. And though he was ill, And diminished in this way, he became very animated when talking about his father. And he spoke to me about the kind of mythical qualities that his father had that helped him, these kind of supernatural qualities that he say helped him in his resistance. He said when his father walked around carrying the papers of the community, meeting with judges and politicians, he traveled around the country by foot. And he said he could speak with plants, he could speak with animals, and he had this power so that when the authorities tried to kill him, Barco told me, they tried to burn him, but he would not burn. They tried to drown him, but he would not drown. And these kind of mythical or supernatural powers or qualities that Tula had were something that the TOA didn't ignore. They looked into this. And myth created a window into deeper Andean meanings around political resistance. Myth was something that was ignored by many historians or was completely, not part of the account in courts or in the newspapers at the time. So hearing these stories from Barco, and this was something that the TOA explored as well, really created another window into the meaning of these resistances. And that was a very powerful experience to me, for me to meet with Barco and do some of the same kind of oral testimonies, collecting these oral testimonies, which was such a core part of the TOA's work over so many years.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious, ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and
and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor is the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
Yeah, that was a particularly fascinating part of the book in chapter 5 when you talk about looking into Santos Marcatula's story and his history and relevancy, not just to his family and his community, but also to a broader indigenous movement across Bolivia. And something that I found particularly interesting is how Tula and other activists who joined him in the effort to resist the breakup, dispossession, and redistribution of indigenous land drew upon a 400-year-old legal history to resist these efforts. Can you talk a little bit more about how these turn-of-the-century indigenous activists use these very old histories in order to achieve legal recourse to protect their lands and their communities?
Yeah, definitely. This was a really fascinating part of the resistance, and it's still being used today by indigenous communities, which I can also talk about. So as a part of these, as a part of the TOA's work, they found out that Santos Marcatula had traveled, along with other caciques and poblados, had traveled around to different archives, historical archives in Bolivia, and other caciques had traveled outside of Bolivia to Lima, and even as far away as Buenos Aires. And they were looking for some of the original land titles of their communities so that when the government or private corporations or haciendas were seeking to dispossess their land, some of these titles said, our ancestors went to the Mita, which is a form of forced, basically, enslavement in the mines of Potosí by the Spanish, by the colonial powers in the Spanish in the 16th century. These titles said, our ancestors went to the Mita. They worked in Potosí. They paid their tribute. They paid their taxes so that they could own their land, which, of course, was taken from them by the Spanish, but they had this title to say this, these 400-year-old titles. And Tula found these. Other caciques and poblados found these, and they used them as tools in their legal and political struggle to say, this land is ours. This document shows this. So they use these titles in their struggles, and the defense of those titles and the kind of preservation of them, literally the physical document, was so important to these caciques. And they used them, and that was a profound discovery, or really a rediscovery, by the TOA in the 1980s. Silvia Rivera Cusicanqui talks about this really incredible process that the TOA went through when they found this out. They were so impressed. Obviously, it wasn't anything new, but the TOA really put these pieces together, as TOA members describe. It was like their kind of work of putting these histories together was like taking up a letter that had been torn into many pieces and putting it back together like a puzzle. And so using those land titles was an important part of that. And it really shows how history is used as a tool of resistance in this longer process of decolonization. And incredibly, when I was back in Bolivia earlier this year, members of the Caracara Nation, an indigenous community in the lowlands of Bolivia, and their leader, Tata Samuel Flores, I spoke with him, and he was at this time marching against, in defense of his community's lands under the Morales government. So this is before Morales was overthrown earlier this year. This was in March, and there are many, of course, movements protesting against Morales over the 14 years he's in power, as well as many communities supportive of the MAS government. But what Samuel Flores from this community brought with him in a 40-day march to La Paz was the title to his land from the 16th century. And he was showing this to me and had stamps all over it from, you know, proving its legitimacy. And he used the exact, it was almost the exact same discourse that people like Tula had used, 100 years ago. He said, you know, this document shows that our ancestors went to the mines, paid their tribute, paid their taxes. This document shows that the land is ours. And he was using that in a struggle in contemporary Bolivia to, against the breakup of that community's land in a different context under the Morales government. And so it was really incredible to hear these stories and how historical research is such a core part of these indigenous movements.
In your final chapter, you conclude with an emphasis on the power of community as well as continuity. The reconstitution of the IUs during the last two decades of the 20th century provided indigenous activists who would come to transform the Bolivian political landscape in the early 2000s with a historical purpose. How do the IUs and the history these communities embody in their continued existence allow indigenous activists to eventually pave the way for an indigenous president? In what ways are the powers of history at work here?
So the IUs in the 1990s, this network of IUs, which, as I mentioned, go back to even before the Incan Empire as a form of community organizing, they worked with the TOA to reconstitute themselves legally and politically as IUs. And the TOA worked with them to gather oral histories about the boundaries of their territory, or the traditions of rotational leadership, the titles of the different positions within this local governance model, and the names of those positions, and the traditions of specific communities across particularly the highlands of Bolivia and near Potosí. And the IUs created a national network in 1997 called the CONAMAC, and they constituted a new political force that was had the IUs as the core base of this national organization, which was also organized in a traditional format as it went up to the ranks through the regional and national level into a national federation. So the CONAMAC exists to this day, and they were a part in the late 1990s into the early 2000s of what came to be a major rejection of the neoliberal model, a model of privatization instead of state control of services, a model of undermining workers' rights, a model of dispossessing indigenous people of their land and suppressing the working class. Neoliberalism was on trial in the early 2000s in Bolivia, and the CONAMAC, the CESUCEME, the Campesino Union, different currents of Indianismo and Catarismo, as well as the at this time very important Cocalero movement, and different syndical and workers unions around the country organized against different neoliberal policies that sought to privatize water, that sought to privatize gas, that sought to implement International Monetary Fund and World Bank policies at the on the backs of the working poor. And in 2000, 2003, when I started working in the country as a journalist, these movements were really turning the country upside down, united regionally and politically against presidents like Gonzalo Sanchez de Lozada, against multinational corporations like Bechtel, one of the biggest multinational corporations in the world, against the IMF and the World Bank. And they kicked out presidents, they kicked out multinational corporations, and through this wave of protests and uprisings, they ushered in the opening that created the space for Evo Morales to be elected as president in 2005. He rode the wave of mobilizations. He was a part of them, not always in the front lines, but he was an important part of them, and that culture, that radical political culture, was what the MAS, the Movement Towards Socialism, the political party of Evo Morales, emerged out of. And Morales, when he took office in 2006 after his election, he really institutionalized a lot of the victories that had already been won in the streets socially, saying we're going to nationalize gas, we're going to create a constitutional assembly to decolonize the state and create and kind of institutionalize land reform on a deeper level, and create more economic and political sovereignty against U.S. imperialism. So the different threads and currents of these kind of decolonized historical narratives in the early 2000s were very important. They were part of a very complex series of causes and discourses at this time, which led to these grassroots political victories. So at the barricades, people talked about Qatari, as I mentioned. They talked about, carrying on 500 years of resistance, the cocaleros, which came to the forefront of this movement. So they're coca farmers who are growing coca leaves to meet a legal market, a legal demand in the country, organized into unions in the lowlands of Bolivia in particular. And the coca leaf, which is used to kind of alleviate altitude sickness or as a pain reliever, it's used among workers and miners, like coffee is widely in the U.S. as a stimulant. People would chew these leaves or drink them in tea. And the symbol of the coca leaf was also a part of some of these discourses where it unified the struggle of the miners who chewed the coca leaf in the mines with the struggle of the indigenous peasants who produced the coca leaf and had used the coca leaf in ceremonies and in traditions. And so the coca leaf became a symbol for the MAS party of indigenous resistance, of anti-imperialism against the U.S.-led war on drugs, of the labor movement. So there's that aspect, which is very present in the 2000s. You also have this political analysis, which has been sustained for centuries, regarding recognizing and dissecting the different forms of colonialism internally and internationally, and saying, the new colonizers are Bechtel, and IMF, and the World Bank, and U.S. troops and military, and the U.S. embassy. This is the new form of colonization. And this was a kind of political analysis and lens that had been sustained for decades and centuries. And looking over the threads that I look at from the book from the 1950s into today, it's no surprise that these demands, this decolonial vision, and this decolonial analysis was so present at the barricades and these protests, because it's been something that's been at the core of many movements for so long. So these are some of the ways that history and these historical symbols and narratives were present during that period.
I want to conclude with a question about the recent ousting and departure of Evo Morales from presidential office. Throughout your book, you talk about the power of a historical consciousness of continuity, how indigenous peoples in Bolivia understand themselves as part of this 500-year rebellion against the many vestiges of colonialism and neocolonialism. Of course, it's impossible to say now what his presidency and his departure will mean for indigenous Bolivian history, say a century from now. But I would like to ask you this. How is this moment in Bolivia's indigenous history, this sudden and it seems cataclysmic coup against Bolivia's first indigenous president, being understood and made sense of now? Indigenous activists and organizations in Bolivia have long utilized history as a means of resistance, as you indicate in your book. Can you gather how these activists and organizations are grasping this moment in their history?
Excellent question. And it's very complicated. So just to kind of piece it together, on October 20th, there was an election that Evo Morales was running in, and a series of conflicts followed the contested results of those elections. And just kind of fast forward through really a complex series of events. Jeanine Añez took power on November 12th, following Evo Morales stepping down on November 10th in what is widely considered a coup, because of the ways in which the military and the police were involved in leading to Evo's ouster, and because of the ways that the far right took advantage of the situation and filled the political power vacuum, and then used the seizure of power to repress dissidents, particularly people who supported Evo Morales, in incredible incredibly horrific massacres following Añez's assumption of power in what I see as a coup. This isn't to erase the long, you know, there are a lot of, this isn't to describe it a coup, in my mind, does not erase the very real and factual critiques that people had over Morales's 14 years in power. There were a lot of critiques against his consolidation of power, extractivism, environmental records, human rights records, and also desire to run again as president in spite of a 2016 referendum that where the people decided to bar him from running again. So these grievances accumulated into protest against Morales after the October 20th election. At the same time, there's a lot of there over this time has been a lot of support for the Morales government in terms of its policies around economic sovereignty, indigenous rights, land reform, and economic policies, which have really lifted a lot of some of the poorest sectors of the country out of poverty and empowered marginalized sectors of the country. So there's a lot of pros and cons to the Morales government over 14 years, and that shouldn't be ignored by describing the situation on November 10th and 12th as a coup. I think it was a series of very complex forces, but in the end, it was a coup that took place with which the right took advantage of and has used that to repress people and clamp down on democracy and create a politics of vengeance against the MAS and its allies. And I think it should be denounced. And I think it should be denounced in terms of the U.S. blessing of this process, which Donald Trump did. So that given, there have been a lot of really striking ways that these continuity, that these issues of decolonizing history have been at play following the coup. So immediately following Evo Morales being forced out of office, when Evo stepped down and left the country, some of the police that had declared mutiny against Evo in the days prior burned the Wifala flag, and other members of the dissident groups that were protesting Morales burned the Wifala flag around the presidential palace, took them off their police uniforms. And this is something that connects the dots to what I talk about in my book. The Wifala flag is a multicolored rainbow flag that represents the many indigenous nations in Bolivia, which is over 43 different indigenous nations, primarily Aymara, Quechua, and Guarani. But the flag represents these nations, these cultures, these histories, these languages. And to desecrate it, to burn it like that, really outraged a lot of people. The Wipala had also been used by the MAS government as a symbol of indigeneity and indigenous liberation. And the Wipala had been used as a kind of symbol of the MAS on planes, on uniforms, in a lot of rallies and political material. So the burning of it also was a rejection of the MAS. So but what happened right after this was really these incredible protests and mobilizations in defense of the Wipala, where you have thousands and thousands of people in the streets of Bolivia protesting the desecration of the Wipala, which is really a desecration of the kind of indigeneity in the country and the diversity of indigenous nations in the country. And they're saying, you know, you can't touch this flag. You can't use it in this way. You can't desecrate it in this way. Many of them also, they had it in rallies, and it was just so many Wipalas. Back in the early 2000s, when I started working in the country, you didn't really see Wipalas around that much, as much as, you know, right after this coup happened. I mean, there were so many of these flags everywhere. I'm talking about La Paz, but also in other cities around the country. And it was incredible to see these rallies and then watching video reports of military jets flying low over these rallies. And that to me just evoked the periods of dictatorship that Bolivia has overcome. But it evoked the periods of dictatorship of the 1970s when the Cataristas, the Indianistas, Genaro Flores were starting to really use the Wipala on a more mainstream political level as a symbol. And they were also using it to resist military suppression. So that image to me was really striking and tragic to see that kind of history, those gains rolled back. So the Wifala is another symbol of that. And another, in this period of resistance against the Áñez regime and in the push for democracy during these dark days, there were a series of road blockades. I think it was 121 different road barricades set up around the country by MAS supporters against the Áñez government. And they were literally trying to strangle the cities and pressure the government into meeting their demands. And that was the exact language and strategies that I talk about so often in my book and the activists use over this time to say, we are the heirs of these struggles. We are carrying on Qatari's legacy. Before Qatari was killed, he said, you can kill me, but I will return as millions. And it's this phrase that's often repeated politically, but it shouldn't be discounted because it really centers the role of this historical analysis and these historical tools at the barricades. So after Áñez took power, these 121 barricades were talking about that and literally trying to strangle the cities in the same way that Qatari did. So that to me just brings back these same threads and echoes these same narratives and discourses around centering these historical tools in the resistance now against a very undemocratic government. There are elections on the horizon for May 3rd, scheduled for May 3rd now in Bolivia, and different political parties are organizing and putting candidates forward. The MAS is participating in this as well, but Evo Morales is not, nor is his vice president. So those are some of the ways that these political tools are being used now, as I've witnessed.
Great. Thank you so much for all of that information. We've taken up a lot of your time today, but before we wrap up, I have one last question for you. What are you working on now?
So I'm looking at trying to put together the pieces of these events around the coup and the October 20th election. It's incredible the level of things that have happened since October 20th. A lot of people expected a kind of peaceful resolve or transfer of power or electoral victory for Evo, but it's really been some of the most eventful moments in Bolivian history. And I think historians and journalists and researchers and everyone will be picking the events of these days apart for a long time, debating them. And I'm trying to do the same, really understand what happened, put the pieces together. I'm planning more research trips to Bolivia to do that, but also look particularly at the ways that history is being used as a tool of resistance in Bolivia today under this current situation.
Ben, that sounds like another very important project. I want to thank you for being on the show today. I really enjoyed it. Take care.
Thank you so much.